Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us Mr. Nicolas Bornozis, Capital Link President and organizer of the event. I must advise you the conference is being recorded today, and we now pass the floor to Mr. Bornozis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good morning to everybody. This is Nicolas Bornozis, and I'm the president of Capital Link, and welcome to Capital Link's webinar series. We're particularly pleased to have with us today, in today's webcast, Cohen and Steers, on the topic of finding opportunities in closed-end funds and the focus on energy infrastructure. We have with us our two featured presenters, Douglas Bond, Executive Vice President and Portfolio Manager, and Benjamin Morton, Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager. This event is accessible through a live audio webcast, and then will also be available as an audio archive upon demand through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. Please note that the presentation slides are user-controlled. To access this presentation, please look to the top right-hand corner and you will see two buttons titled Preview Slide and Next Slide. So by clicking on the button of your choice, you can move forward or backward on the presentation. There will be a Q&A session after the presentation. Webinar participants can submit questions through the special button on the event page titled Submit a Question, or you can email them to us at questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. You can submit a question anytime during the event. I would like to say that the opinions expressed by the presenters are not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and Capital Link bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, the presentation may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. And I will close by saying that Capital Link's 16th Annual Closed-End Funds and Global ETFs Forum will take place on Thursday, April 27, 2017, at the Metropolitan Club in New York City. We're particularly proud that this event has a 16-year track record, and we look forward to it. And, of course, Cohen and Steers has been one of our most loyal and significant participants. There is no attendance fee for the advisors and investors to attend. And to register, please visit forums.capitallink.com. And the forum will qualify for continuing education credits. And now I will turn the floor over to Doug, and thank you to Cohen and Steers for being with us today with such a great webinar. Doug, please, the floor is yours.
All right, thank you, Nicolas. Before we get to Doug, this is Ted Valenti, and good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today on this webcast titled Finding Opportunities in Closed-End Funds, Spotlight on Energy Infrastructure. I'm Senior Vice President and Senior Product Manager at the firm here, and I'm delighted to be joined by Doug, who is an Executive Vice President and Portfolio Manager of the Cohen and Steers Closed-End Opportunity Fund, symbol FOF, and Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager Ben Morton, who is Portfolio Manager of Cohen and Steers Infrastructure Fund, UTF, and Cohen and Steers MLP Income and Energy Opportunity Fund, MIE. Both Ben and Doug also manage portfolios of open-end funds, separate accounts, and provide portfolio selection for unit investment trusts that are available through our partners at Advisors Asset Management, AAM for short. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. We recognize that we have many Cohen and Steers asset holders on the line with us, and we're grateful for all of you and your investments and trust that you place in Doug, Ben, and Cohen and Steers. Closed-end funds have become a staple of the retail investment community for sure, and they offer access to a wide range of asset classes and investment strategies that are wrapped in packages that have the potential to generate high levels of income and total return. And looking at the page titled The Firm at a Glance in our presentation deck, you can see the second chart about 9. This is updated since I produced this slide. We released assets last night. $9.3 billion of our total assets under management are in closed-end funds, making Cohen & Steers one of the largest issuers of closed-end funds out there. And in recognition of that, We're going to use 2 minutes of today's call to launch a new section of our public website called the Cohen & Steers Closed-End Fund Knowledge Center. So after the webinar, I encourage all of you to go to www.cohenandsteers.com, and once you're there, go to the section on the homepage that's titled Topics of Interest. The first link under Topics of Interest is our Hot Off the Press Cohen & Steers Closed-End Fund Learning Center. Learning Center is more than just a learn the basics type web page that you may see elsewhere. It has a lot of information pertaining to our closed-end fund offerings and their underlying asset classes. And through this page, we share our portfolio managers' views through published thought leadership and commentary, as well as short market minute videos. And additionally, we're going to provide links to external closed-end fund focus educational and industry sites like Capital Link, so you can explore other concepts and points of view, and hopefully we find it useful and we welcome your feedback there. So with that Cohen and Steers commercial, let's get on to the webcast. Doug is going to deliver a closed-end fund update, speak about closed-end funds in a rising interest rate environment, and give his outlook for the foreseeable future, highlighting specific sectors where he's finding value and speak about one or two where he is not. And Ben will then talk about a very important topic and one that's in the headlines and the papers on the news these days and is a focal point of the new presidential administration, energy infrastructure. He'll cover the sectors within listed infrastructure, speak about how the new political regime may impact it, talk about some of the drivers, and focus on the midstream energy sector, highlighting North America's position to gain some market share in the future. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Doug and then to Ben afterwards. And at the conclusion of their comments, we look forward to answering your questions. So Doug, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Ted. And thanks, Nicholas, and for everybody tuning in to today's webinar. We're on, just so if you're able to follow along with your slide presentation, we're on slide four, titled Closed End Fund Update. And I guess I would say that the story about closed end funds in 2016 was mostly a positive story. Investment experiences were broadly positive. In the taxable fixed income and equity sectors, there was only one sector of 20-plus sectors that was actually down on market price, and that was a relatively small part of the market, the healthcare sector, which was actually down double digits on market price. But broadly, taxable fixed income was the total return leadership part of the market. On average, funds there rising more than 18%, and the average total return across the equity closed-end fund complex was positive 14%. And there were also double-digit returns on net asset value. The away from healthcare, the area of trouble in terms of total return for closed-end funds in 2016 was the municipal sector, where the funds were actually down on market price for the year, but eked out positive 1% total returns based upon the income flow that the muni funds gave their investors. Discounts narrowed broadly. The discount narrowing was most pronounced in taxable fixed income, where total returns were bolstered by more than 4%. From the discount narrowing during 2016. That discount narrowing and positive investment performance has continued in the first 2 months of this year. Unlike 2016, where fixed income, taxable fixed income led the way, this year equities are leading the way, and the discount compression is greatest in the equity asset class, as the NAVs are up about 5% year-to-date through February, but market prices are up 8%, so there's been about 3 percentage points of discount narrowing. Borrowing costs for closed-end funds, three-quarters of all closed-end funds use leverage in their capital structure in order to bolster income levels and total returns. Borrowing costs are low on an absolute basis, but expected Fed tightening at the upcoming March meeting, as well as a couple of incremental tightenings in the balance of 2017, suggest to us that fund earnings power is going to be diminished somewhat, even as yield borrowing costs remain low on an absolute level, even if you incorporate the expected hikes later this year. On the new issue front, 2016 was a sort of third consecutive year of less and less new issue activity. To us, that's a positive technical consideration, as a absence of new supply has most investors focused on the secondary market. Page 5 of the presentation shows that evergreen characteristic of closed-end funds offering a current yield that's in excess of many alternatives in different equity and fixed income asset classes and alternatives in the marketplace. You can see at the far left of that slide, closed-end funds, current yield, five-year average yield about in the mid-7, 7.6%, and that compares very favorably to high yield, where the current yield is actually below that five-year average, or corporate bonds, muni bonds, and the 10-year treasury as you move to the right on that slide. If you turn to page 6 of the presentation, it's just a broad a snapshot of the broad income alternatives, both current distribution yields and premium discount levels. At the far left, you can see the multi-sector and U.S. equity dividend groups delivering yields greater than 9% on a current basis, moving all the way over to the health, biotech, and global equity sectors with yields in the mid-7s as of the end of February. And then on the right part of that page 6, you can see premium discount levels as high as 12% in the U.S. general equity area, moving all the way over to the right of the side of the page, where limited duration and equity discounts in excess of 6%, or utility discounts in excess of 6% as of the end of the month of February. On page 7, we provide an overview of long-term equity discounts to net asset value. This is as of the end of December 2016. Equity discounts were still as wide as 8.5%. The average historical discount for equity closed-end funds, 5.2%. And you can actually see on the left side of that graph that if you look in the sort of time period 2002 to 2004 is really the only time in the history portrayed on this slide during this 20-year period between 1997 and 2017, where equity closed-end funds actually sold at a premium to net asset value. Most of the time, they're available at a discount. As of the end of February, that discount actually was in the high 5s, so discount moving toward that long-term average and reflecting some optimism on future growth and equity's ability to defend in a potentially higher interest rate and maybe higher inflation environment. One of the biggest single questions that we receive is in terms of the closed-end fund market is what are some of the best groups that you might consider owning, or what does better in a rising rate environment? If you turn to slide 8 in the presentation, what we do is we highlight the top three and bottom three performers in both equity and fixed income in terms of sectors of the closed-end fund market that do the best or the worst following a substantial backup in the 10-year Treasury yield as an indicator of rising interest rates. So what this is generally showing is what does best in the 12 months following a 30% plus rise in the 10-year Treasury yield. In terms of equity sectors, the top three performers are REIT, equity tax advantaged, and the financial sector. The bottom three performers, generally commodity, energy, and global equity. Within the fixed income category, when rates rise, historically, the best forward total returns are found in preferred securities, senior loan, and multi-sector, and the worst in government, global income, and mortgage bonds. Turning to page 9 of the presentation, in terms of our outlook for the closed-end fund market, we feel currently with discounts for taxable fixed income closed-end funds and municipal closed-end funds near or through their long-term averages is that there isn't really a lot of prospect for further discount narrowing among the fixed income closed-end funds, but we do think that the equity closed-end fund discounts could narrow modestly during 2017. They've come in over 200 basis points since the beginning of the year. We think there's the possibility for incremental discount narrowing. We continue to feel like the closed-end fund distribution yields will benefit from historically low borrowing costs, although the prospect of rising costs are likely to reduce this benefit as 2017 and even 2018 unfold. The best opportunities that we're finding in the marketplace are equity closed-end funds trading at above average long-term discounts to net asset value. We do find selective opportunities among taxable fixed income funds, and we have taken advantage recently of what we would consider to be a tactical buying opportunity in the muni closed-end funds, which sold off pretty extensively following the Trump election victory and the backup in the 10-year Treasury market that occurred at year-end in November and into early December. If you turn to page 10 of the presentation, it shows you how the Cohen & Steers Closed-End Opportunity Fund is currently positioned, and show the green bars at the top of the chart indicate groups and sectors of the closed-end fund market where we are overweight. The red bars are indications of where we're currently underweight at February 28th, and you can see that in terms of the top three overweight positions are all equity closed-end fund sectors, covered call, equity tax advantaged, and MLP significantly overweight versus the index benchmark, notwithstanding the fact that the MLP closed-end funds enjoyed a significant recovery following the February lows in energy markets in 2016. We do continue to feel like there is more to go in that recovery. I think people's tendency is often to feel like they ought to fade big moves, but we remind people that notwithstanding those big moves, many of these Master Limited Partnership closed-end funds fell 80% from their initial offering prices before enjoying a substantial recovery following the February lows in energy. Covered call funds was one of the underperforming equity sectors last year. The funds continue to trade at 6% plus discounts to net asset value and offer close to 9% distribution yields. We continue to find that group interesting. And, you know, among fixed income, the multi-sector and municipal fund groups show up as overweight. We continue to like the multi-sector funds for their attractive combination of high current distribution yield and strong earnings power, even as the valuations there have gotten full relative to where they were a year ago. We're underweight the high yield sector, and we have sort of preferred to get our exposure to high yield through the multi-sector funds, which we found is a better way to participate in that market. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to Ben Morton.
Thanks, Doug, and thanks, everyone. I'm going to speak for a bit about broader infrastructure as it relates to diversified infrastructure strategy as represented by UTF, which Ted introduced earlier, and then a little bit of a highlight on midstream energy and our outlook there and energy infrastructure, which, again, is something that we access in a pure form through MIE. So first on slide 12, just highlighting how do we define infrastructure, and I think one has to appreciate sort of the core real asset definition of infrastructure, which is the owners and operators of infrastructure assets and businesses. So what are the common characteristics of these businesses? They tend to be monopolistic, although in some cases they're duopolies or oligopolies. They tend to be regulated, but again, there can be concession-based infrastructure or contractual infrastructure. But ultimately, what you get with these types of characteristics are assets with high barriers to entry. They're long-lived assets, and because of this, you have predictable cash flows, and cash flows that are often linked to inflation, whether it's through a regulatory mechanism or a concession agreement that has explicit revenue linkages to or pricing linkages to inflation. What's complex about this asset class as it relates to, analyzing and investing in these businesses? Certainly regulation, where, the regulatory oversight of a number of these businesses, particularly at certain times, is clearly the biggest challenge that we face in investing in this asset class on a day-to-day basis, and we spend a great deal of our time understanding, potential regulatory outcomes. I'd argue that over the last several years, it's been more of a question about politics and political outcomes as the line between politics and regulation has become increasingly blurred. So again, we spend a great deal of time sensitizing our views relative to expectations for regulatory and political outcomes. Security structure, there are ways to access infrastructure through REITs in the form of cell tower companies, MLPs, energy infrastructure through MLPs, as well as, new forms of new security structures that are focused on income delivery that house infrastructure assets. And it's a capital-intensive set of businesses, so that in itself comes with its own risks, and I'll address those further in the presentation. You'll see in the bottom of 12 sort of a list of the various businesses that we would include in infrastructure, everything from traditional transportation infrastructure, such as airports, marine ports, toll roads, and railways, to energy infrastructure, which we highlight here as pipelines, telecommunications infrastructure, that would be satellites and tower companies. Why so narrow within the communications universe is because these businesses tend to have long-term contracts and therefore predictable cash flows. And then utilities, which can be electric utilities, gas utilities, or water. Slide 13 hits on our most often asked question these days, which is, particularly in the U.S., how do you think infrastructure will be impacted by the Trump victory and congressional sweep for Republicans? And the short answer there is, as you think about all of the various policies, we think overall it's a positive thing for the asset class. If you look at the bottom row on slide 13, we attempt to speak to some of these drivers. So first, when you think about midstream energy, we focus on the improving economic outlook, which may come with some of these Republican policies, and we're already starting to see that flow through to consumer sentiment and market sentiment, but in theory through to economic data as we move through the year with the strong economic data this morning, clearly a testament to what we were already seeing in terms of improving economic conditions throughout the second half of last year. This should benefit some of the more sensitive subsectors that we have within our strategy to economic conditions, and for us that would be the freight railways, which continue to perform well. Midstream energy is another subsector that can potentially benefit from Trump/Republican policies. We've already begun to see that happen. So the two places that we would say we could see policy shifts that improve the outlook would be one, fewer restrictions as it relates to drilling. So E&P companies likely having more flexibility around production of energy, which to us just means, rising production volumes and therefore greater throughput volumes for energy infrastructure assets, so pipelines, processing facilities, and storage facilities. So volumes are a key driver of cash flows for the companies in that space, so that would be a benefit. And then secondly, I'd say there's been a real move over the past 12 to 18 months and a growing environmental empathy as it relates to pipeline projects that are on the docket. Think about something like the DAPL pipeline going through North Dakota that we saw a ton of pushback for. I think with the new administration, we're likely to see, at least at a federal level, some easing of that environmental empathy, and we've already seen outcomes there. So you've seen a handful of pipeline projects approved at the federal level just in the last month. So, of course, there's still going to be state hurdles, but clearly we see a friendlier federal environment when it comes to the midstream energy space. The last thing I'd say in terms of a tailwind is more of a medium to long-term tailwind, and that is depending on how, for example, an infrastructure fiscal stimulus package evolves, ultimately to us the whole thesis behind investing in infrastructure relates to underinvestment that we've seen historically and what that's led to, which is rapidly declining service quality. You've seen that with examples being Flint, Michigan, and the terrible situation there with regard to water quality. You've seen that with deteriorating quality of service as it relates to entities like Amtrak. It's our belief that with the incredible focus on infrastructure and the trillion dollars that's being proposed to spend on infrastructure, that the market will have to appreciate the fact that the best owners, operators, and financers of infrastructure businesses over the long term are the private sector, not municipalities. So we would expect that another tailwind for this asset class as it relates to the attention that infrastructure is getting today would be likely increased privatization and private sector ownership and operation over the long term. A headwind, and this is in the middle of slide 13, one that clearly stands out as potential for rising rates to impact infrastructure in a negative way. And I'll address that in a subsequent slide, but I'd also note that that's one of the hallmarks of this asset class is you have a diverse set of businesses that one can invest in, and you can toggle your portfolio to lean one direction or another based upon your view on a handful of macro drivers. So, yes, a subsector like utilities tends to have more sensitivity to rising rates, but in that scenario where we believe rates were going to go up, we could be materially underweight utilities, yet overweight those subsectors that are most likely to outperform in periods of rising rates and the improving economic conditions that are likely to accompany those rising rates. So moving on to slide 14, what's the fundamental secular driver of this infrastructure investment story? It's a simple one, and it's been in developed markets. It's been underinvestment in infrastructure over the last several decades, and we show here infrastructure spending as percentage of GDP, which has declined materially Obviously, the percentage hasn't changed a lot, but when you think about that in dollar terms, it's massive. And what this has led to, again, is rapidly deteriorating service quality, whether it's blackouts that we've seen across North America in extreme weather scenarios, whether it's the issues like we've seen in Flint, Michigan, or, again, something like an Amtrak. We need to invest in our infrastructure. In emerging markets, you'll see that table on the right, which highlights a number of emerging markets and some developed. It's really a different trend. It's the need to accommodate very powerful demographic trends like urbanization, rising standards of living. And what we see here is, you know, basic goods and services, whereby in developed markets there's significant penetration per capita. In emerging markets, you're still lagging materially. So it's just that need to provide these basic services which is driving incremental investment and incremental growth for these companies. Slide 15 sort of highlights the diversification benefit of investing in listed infrastructure, as well as the ability to benefit from active management in these portfolios. So if we look at, again, slide 15, the left-hand side, you'll see economic sensitivity. The bottom you see inflation sensitivity, and what we show here is there's a broad spectrum of sensitivity to each of these macro drivers among the various infrastructure subsectors. So take, for example, marine ports. They tend to be the most sensitive within our global universe to changes in economic conditions, with utilities and satellite companies being the least sensitive to changes. So again, depending on our view on economies worldwide and the overall global economy, we can toggle our portfolio to be more or less sensitive to that view. As it relates to inflation, toll roads are clearly the most sensitive to changes in inflation. When you think about that, most toll roads have, call it 25 to 99 year concession agreements with local governments, whereby they're allowed to raise tolls annually at a rate linked to inflation. So there's a very direct linkage with inflation. There are other subsectors that clearly have less linkages. Like a utility, for example, where their rate-setting mechanism tends to occur, at least here in the U.S., on a once-every-several-year basis, which means there's going to be material lag in terms of passing along inflationary cost pressures in terms of their cash flows. So what has this led to? Slide 16 shows the tremendous dispersion of returns that we've seen among infrastructure subsectors. So if you look back to, for example, the periods of 2008 and 2009, you saw the most defensive infrastructure subsectors, which were, frankly, then the passenger railways in Japan, as well as the electric companies and gas utilities, as the best performing, with some of the more economically sensitive names being the worst performing, toll roads, airports, and marine ports. If you flip that to 2009, 1 year ahead, you'll see some of the more economically sensitive massively outperforming the more defensive utility subsectors and, again, passenger railways, which are reflected there. You'll see every year subsequent, we've had material, 25-30% plus, dispersion of returns between the top-performing and bottom-performing subsector. And, again, this often reflects, you know, secular trends for those specific businesses, but is clearly driven by macro conditions, whether it's, you know, the economic cycle, the credit cycle, or the interest rate cycle. Slide 17, as I noted, you know, interest rates being a key driver, another question we're getting quite frequently today is, you know, how does infrastructure as an asset class perform in periods of rising rates? And I think this slide attempts to answer that question. On the left-hand side, what you'll see are the 10 or so periods of greatest one-month interest rate increases here in the U.S. And what you'll see there is infrastructure relative to equities has materially underperformed in those extreme periods. So we show here 182 basis points of underperformance during those 1 month periods. We actually, in the blue bar at the bottom of that table, we show since Trump, and that was a bit of a longer period, almost 2 months from 11/8/16 through the end of the year, and we'll show, again, material underperformance. Not surprising, given a perception that this is an asset class that tends to be more rate sensitive. And it is true, there are some parts of the asset class that are, again, utilities. But if you look at the right-hand side, What we show here is infrastructure's performance relative to global equities in the 3, 6, and 12 month periods following that period of extreme rate increases. What we see there is, given the fact that there are a number of infrastructure subsectors that we believe can really benefit from the likely inflationary environment and economic environments that are likely to accompany these types of interest rate increases, infrastructure is actually materially outperformed in those periods following that initial knee-jerk reaction. So the short answer there is knee-jerk reactions have tended to be interesting entry points for investors as it relates to infrastructure strategies. Slides 18 and 19 relate to specifically to midstream energy. So I guess what I'd say here is we're positive on the outlook for midstream energy. We've had a thesis of rising crude oil prices really for about just under a year now, where we believe that the supply response was happening as it relates to E&P companies cutting back on their capex materially. And something that we believed, when combined with improving demand, which we expected to continue to see, would lead to a rebalancing of the crude oil markets and therefore modestly higher prices over time. Now, of course, OPEC's decision in, let's say, late last year to essentially cap production accelerated that trend for us, such that we're very confident about a floor being set in terms of crude oil prices in this, call it, 45 and above range, which presents upside, of course, to the $60 to $65 range to the extent production cuts stay in place and demand continues to grow. So what we show on slide 18 is why we believe North America is primed to really benefit from this pricing regime for crude oil and a gradually increasing price over time. So it's our belief, again, that North American shale is the most competitive source of energy today. And it's really for two reasons. What we show here is breaking costs are competitive, whereby, you know, production costs have come down to a degree in North America that we believe many shale plays are economical at $40 versus certainly places that have spare capacity, meaning offshore and oil sands, being less competitive at $50 and $60 plus. And places like OPEC, more conventional production, clearly being cheaper in terms of their production, but having very little spare capacity. So we have the spare capacity, we have the cheap production, and even more so, we have the speed to market. So what you'll see here is 6 months from decision to drill to producing energy versus very long lead times for offshore and very long lead times for oil sands. So we believe that putting all this together, North America gains market share in the overall supply equation. So what does this mean for midstream energy on slide 19? Clearly, we've overbuilt as it relates to crude oil pipelines in North America, and we show that here. The green line represents pipeline utilization, so the percent of overall capacity, and we see that falling to, you know, in 2017 to nearly 70 or just under 70%. And that's because of what we've seen in terms of the blue bars outpacing the orange bars. Blue bars are new pipelines added in terms of supply, or orange bars are demand. So we've added much more than we've needed. That came at a time when North American oil production fell. Now that we expect to see a rebound in oil production, given that gaining of market share by North America, we expect that pipeline utilization to ramp up, which is a great trend ultimately for pipeline operators, because there's very high operating leverage. The pipelines, the steel, they've already been built, they're in the ground. You know, new volumes flow to the bottom line and increase cash flow growth. Slide 20 hits at a sort of a higher level outlook for the space, and I'll just hit on a couple things before turning it back to Ted to conclude. First, I've noted a few of these, election impacts, but I'll perhaps be a little bit more targeted here. Key subsectors potentially impacted from Trump and Republican policies. I hit on midstream. I would say I'd focus on renewables. You know, renewables are a pretty small part of the overall infrastructure universe, but to us an attractive one. And while Trump and some Republicans have been vocal about a focus on more traditional fossil fuels and a disbelief as it relates to global warming, what I'd say here is, you know, the horse has left the barn on this one, and ultimately the decision to invest in renewables is an economic one and no longer a policy-related one. Costs for renewables have come down at a utility scale, such that it's very cost competitive with traditional sources of generation. A number of red states have benefited from investments that have been made in renewables in those regions. It's really become more of a bipartisan effort over the past several years to support renewables. So we're still very optimistic as it relates to wind and solar facilities that have long-term contracts. Then I'd also note, as it relates to tax policy, freight railways have a lot to gain. They're probably among our U.S. entities the most significant cash taxpayers, full cash taxpayers. So to the extent we do see tax reform, we could see material upside to earnings for the freight railways. On top of that, subsector like utilities probably have the least to gain because ultimately over the long term they will see the need to pass along any tax benefits that they get to end-use customers. Two more things to point out on the slide. I've already highlighted freight railways in a number of different ways, but I'd simply say we're seeing a turn in terms of the freight volume story for the railway operators, which is a positive one after many years of, or probably 18 months of underperformance and declining volumes. We're starting to see that turn relating to improvement in the energy cycle as well as just more broadly improving economic data. That comes at a time when we've already seen significant gains in terms of efficiency and cost cutting, but now increased investor activism with the appointment of Hunter Harrison as CEO, or moving of Hunter Harrison from CEO of CP, where he's done a great job of driving efficiencies to CSX and Eastern Railway here in the U.S., just announced earlier this week and rumored for the last month. So we should see some continued gains in terms of efficiency for the freight railways. And we continue to like the cell tower space. We think that's one of the most attractive secular opportunities within the listed infrastructure universe. Slides 21 and 22 just show some of our subsector positioning. But again, a lot of that should align with the theses I've laid out on the various subsectors. So with that, I'll turn it back to Ted.
Okay. Thank you, Ben. And operator, can you remind everyone how to submit questions? We have a few that are already logged, but I'd like to see if we could get a few more.
Certainly, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Ladies and gentlemen, star 1 on your telephone keypad, please.
No, I think if people would like to submit questions, they have to do so electronically because this is a webcast.
Okay. We have several questions already here. So as we wait for a few more to come in, just take a look at the last page of the presentation deck. It lists all 9 of our closed-end funds that we have here, spanning many of our specialty asset classes. And let me remind you that, you know, specific to this call, you know, we offer our infrastructure strategies in all wrappers, and most prominently in closed-end format. Again, Cohen & Steers Infrastructure Fund, ticker symbol UTF, and an open-end format through the Cohen & Steers Global Infrastructure Fund, ticker CSUIX. Our midstream energy strategy is also available in closed-end format through the Cohen & Steers MLP Income and Energy Opportunity Fund, ticker symbol MIE, and an open-end format through the Cohen & Steers MLP and Energy Opportunity Fund, ticker MLOIX. And so whether you're an institutional or an individual investor looking for information on the closed-end fund market in general or a closed-end fund investment in any of our specialty asset classes, we can help for sure. One question came in for Ben here. That's a relatively simple question, but a very important one. So, Ben, is infrastructure investing a global or a U.S. opportunity?
Sure. infrastructure is truly a global opportunity, and I'd say, you know, as it relates to our universe, it's about 50% in the U.S. and 50% outside of the U.S., and what's interesting is, you know, you can access different themes in different parts of the world, so, you know, whereby we have very few privatized and certainly no listed airports and toll roads here in the U.S., there are many parts of the world where you do have a very deep set of investment opportunities in those sort of core and critical infrastructure businesses. So we really think it's a global theme, and it's not just when people think about infrastructure stimulus, of course, there's a lot of hype around potential benefits to the U.S. But I just remind everybody that we've had fiscal stimulus in the form of infrastructure investing occurring in places like Canada, in places like the U.K., in Brazil. So there's been already a lot of other parts of the world where policy has been exceptionally supportive of infrastructure businesses, whether it's specific fiscal packages or just traditional policy support. So I would say, and it's reflected in our product, that this is truly a global opportunity, of course, just by virtue of the universe being somewhat focused on the U.S. with a concentration in North American opportunities.
Okay, that's great, Ben. Thank you. There's another one for Ben here. So you spoke a lot about the new presidential regime and policies. What could a U.S. infrastructure spending plan look like? And can you just reiterate which sectors would benefit the most in your opinion?
Sure. That's literally the trillion-dollar question. Nobody quite knows what the spending plan will look like. There's been a number of proposals put forth. I think, you know, a couple of major questions to be answered before being able to really predict this. You know, how is the spending offset, and will we just increase the deficit to go ahead and move forward with a trillion-dollar plan? What is the prioritization of infrastructure as it relates to other policy imperatives? So I guess, you know, our best guess is that we get some type of a plan in the next 12 to 18 months. It may not be a full trillion-dollar plan. It may be something tempered somewhat. It is likely to be one that, we believe the easiest thing, rather than to do something in the near term, rather than trying to directly involve the private sector from the offset, would be to directly fund on the part of the federal government, directly fund municipal projects. So I think we could see some movement there. I think over the long term, you could see, you know, whether it's the some kind of an infrastructure investment bank, the revival of a Build America bond program, some type of an infrastructure investment trust security vehicle created. I think there can be more creative ways to implement over the long term, but the near term to us is more likely to be as much spending directly on the part of the federal government as they're able to pull off with regard to Congress. I think who's ready to benefit? Again, over the medium term, it clearly is the companies that own and operate, because I think there will be opportunities to own and operate a growing number of infrastructure businesses and assets in the U.S., given challenges on the part of municipalities in terms of owning and operating and financing those assets. But I also think some of these businesses could benefit, like water businesses, where Trump's spoken about, you know, the need to invest in our water infrastructure. To the extent that these water infrastructure companies, some of which we currently invest in today, may benefit from a lower cost of capital going forward. So a lot of questions. Clearly, by that answer, not a ton of clear answers, but we certainly have a feel for the direction of policy here.
Okay, thank you. There are several other infrastructure-related questions, but we're running up against the top of the hour here, and we will take those questions and we will answer them. We have the contact information for those who are asking. For more on infrastructure and MLPs, we've got a ton of stuff on our website. Ben's co-portfolio manager on the MLP side, Tyler Rosenlicht, basically has some videos and some published research and our insight and our video section right on the homepage. Everyone should really take a look at that if you're interested. Doug Bond has a few questions that came in here. One person is asking, There is no category shown for emerging market fund, closed-end funds in your slide deck. Are they a separate category of closed-end funds, and what is your current weight there?
Yeah, we apologize. We didn't include all 30 closed-end fund sectors. Emerging market bond is one of the fixed income closed-end fund sectors. We have a zero weighting there. That is something that, in retrospect or hindsight, would have been a great area for performance during 2016. The funds were up over 30%, 18-19% gain in net asset value. They benefited from the global chase for yield in 2016. What you do show on our slide of weightings is one of the ways that we chose to participate in what we thought would be a broad global recovery in the commodity complex was by going to an overweight in the emerging market equity closed-end funds, which have been largely out of favor and in the marketplace available at double-digit discounts to net asset value. So no emerging market bond funds in the portfolio currently. We've chosen to play EM through the emerging market equity funds, including the Templeton Emerging Market Income Fund.
Okay, and you know, Doug always gets this question, and we're gonna conclude on this because this is a very important topic. And we wrote a paper about this. Doug authored a paper about this topic last year. One of the most common mistakes investors make when selecting individual closed-end funds, and Doug's gonna give you the answer here, but when you go to our website under the Insights section, under All Insights, the paper Doug wrote is How Closed-End Funds Defy Conventional Wisdom on Yields and Discounts. I think everyone should read that because it's very important when you're trying to put together these portfolios. So, Doug, if you want to just address that question, and we'll wrap it up with that.
Well, Ted, I think probably the most common mistakes are an investor buys the fund that's selling at the biggest discount, or an investor buys the fund that has the biggest current yield. And the search process kind of starts with, or begins and ends with, the discount level or the current income level. And we think that there's more to the investment process than just looking at discounts and just looking at yield. And in fact, the white paper comes to the conclusion that the only part of the market where it makes sense to use discounts as a potential driver of the decision-making process is in the muni closed-end funds, and that's just historically. So if you just want, if you take an example from last year, the best equity sector in the closed-end fund market last year was the financial sector of closed-end funds, where funds were up on average 38%. And that group began the year selling at a 4% premium to net asset value with a yield of around 6%, which is one of the lowest yields and highest valuations relative to net asset value. And it outperformed. Within fixed income, the best performing sector last year, or one of the best performing sectors last year, was the senior loan closed-end fund group, which was up in excess of 24%. And it began the year with a yield of around 7%, which was well below the average yield among fixed income closed-end funds of 9. So those would just be two illustrations where yield-focused, discount-focused wouldn't necessarily have led you to some of the best-performing parts of the market. So our sense is got to take it a step beyond discount and a step beyond yield and make an assessment of the asset class potential.
Okay, well, that's That's great, Doug. And Doug and his expertise is available in actively managed strategies and closed-end fund, the Conrad's Closed-End Opportunity Fund, FOF, and through a number of unit investment trusts that are available through AAM, Advisors Asset Management. If you take a look at their website, you go to the unit investment trust portion, and you're going to see Cohen and Steers frequenting their lineup in many of the specialty sectors. You can call us if you have any questions regarding whether you're interested in the closed ends or the unit investment trust or anything else here. So just wrap it up. I want to thank Doug and Ben, and I want to thank Nicholas and Capital Link. Nicholas, you've been a terrific partner through the years, and are a wealth of information for people looking for knowledge in the closed-end and exchange-traded fund space. I encourage people to use Capital Link as a resource. Thank you to all of you who participated. Without our investors and other interested parties, none of this would be possible. For more information on the funds and asset classes we spoke about today or any of our other strategies, please visit cohenandsteers.com. or call 800-330-7348. Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you very much, Ted, for your good words. Thank you, everybody, for being with us today.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That does conclude your conference for today. Thank you all for participating. You may all disconnect.